Welcome to the Joint Committee on Stream Restoration and Species Recovery for April 12th. Today we're going to have input on House Bill 3225, Measure 66 discussions, and a public hearing and possible work session on House Senate Memorial Number 7, which urges Congress to fund and implement a program to study pinniped predation on salmonids and to allow state and federal agencies to remove pinnipeds preying on listed fish stocks at areas of restricted fish passage. Mm-hmm. Today we have a little bit different configuration for the outputs of our committee, and that is Steve informs us that this is the first official day of the internet archiving of every syllable that's being spoken at our salmon committee hearings, SR2 committee hearings, and other committees that are going on in the building. So it just reminds us of the awesome capacity of the internet, and that there are obviously there's obviously too much storage capacity in the world, because they are making this available for people to revisit these issues and listen to these tapes in the future. That's just a little bit terrifying, but there it is. So today we will look at the Measure 66 issues as we've been following the requirements of Measure 66 in House Bill 3225. And today we have Mark Sista, who signed up for the public testimony portion. So we'll go ahead and call Mark Sista from Portland State University. He's available. And any other persons that wish to offer testimony on House Bill 3225.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Sisma from Portland State University. Last week when I testified, the chair invited me to submit some comments on the need for addressing aquatic nuisance species in the bill. And what I'm handing out is a letter that I sent to the chair in response to that. He probably hasn't gotten it yet since I posted it, I think, on Friday. He's just got it. I won't belabor the details because I think the committee is aware of the need. You know, other people have testified, including Representative Thompson, on the need to address aquatic nuisance species. But I just wanted to come here this morning just to make one sort of more general comment, and that's on the bottom of the first page. It deals with Section 17, paragraph 2B, where the bill outlines the goals of the state of Oregon. And in B it says, restore and maintain and enhance the biological, chemical, and physical integrity of the riparian zones and associated uplands of the state's rivers, lakes, estuaries, and estuary systems. And I would just submit that this is really important information to keep the goal in mind and separate that from the method. And it would seem to me like the goal of the state of Oregon would be to restore the biological, chemical, and physical integrity of the aquatic systems that where we live. And to do that, you have to address the uplands and maintain them. But dealing with the uplands is really the method of restoring the biological integrity of the aquatic systems. So it's a subtle change, and maybe it's difficult to grasp this early in the morning on a Monday, but I think it's fundamentally important. When I deal with lake management, I always encourage people to keep the goal in mind and not focus on the process or the method. And I think this is an instance where changing a few words in the bill could really focus the effort a little bit more on what's the real purpose. At least, so as I understand it, the purpose of this legislation. I would suggest, and I wrote this on, I think it's on page 2, that this section could read more clearly by having it rewritten to say, restore and maintain and enhance the biological, chemical, and physical integrity of the state's rivers, lakes, wetlands, estuaries, and their associated riparian zones and uplands. Small change, but I think it really addresses fundamentally what we're trying to do in this city. That's all I'd say. I'll just submit the rest of my comments for you to review, and I can answer any questions.
Co-Chair Messerly has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We wouldn't have a flag just for the settlements as well. And we have a lot of bodies that we will follow through the state and have a lot of settlements. I wish that
Certainly that gets to the physical and biological integrity of the aquatic system, and I'm not minimizing the need to deal with these issues in the uplands. I mean, that's where the sediment's coming from, and in most aquatic restoration programs, the whole goal is to prevent sediment and nutrients from leaving the uplands and getting into the aquatic systems. It's really fundamentally important. But again, it's a subtle difference between, you know, trying to maintain the upland biological integrity. From my perspective, when I deal with aquatic nuisance species, you could spend billions of dollars in the upland and it wouldn't affect the nuisance species in the lake at all. In fact, it might actually enhance their growth, because if you reduce the increased water clarity in a lake, for example, you get more weed growth. So certainly the dealing with the uplands is really critically important, but that's the process or the tool we use to really address the biological, physical, and chemical integrity of the aquatic systems.
Mr. Pittman, I've got a couple of questions. Let's first, for the committee's benefit and my benefit, let's discuss the definition of uplands. If we look at the cross section of a riparian area, and it wouldn't matter whether the riparian area was a coastal stream or a Willamette River Valley tributary or an eastern Oregon seep that leads into a stream. The uplands that you're referring to are within that riparian zone or just outside the riparian zone, feeding into that creek system or that aquatic system. Sometimes when you say uplands to me, I think that's elsewhere.
I don't know the legal or the technical definition of uplands as it applies to this legislation, but when I read uplands, I mean, that means the watershed, so ridgetop to ridgetop. That's what we hear about. So if that's the definition of uplands, then I think my point still is, though, that even though you manage the biological, chemical, and physical integrity of those areas, it doesn't really, I mean, it certainly influences those features of the aquatic system, but it's sort of an indirect reference to what we're really trying to do, and it seems to me like it would be, you know, somebody once said, you know, begin with the end in mind, and if the end is the biological, physical, and chemical integrity of the aquatic systems, then we should address it in the language of the bill, I would think.
Mr. Sisson, when you discussed in your input the issue of nuisance species, can you give me an idea of what some of the management toolbox looks like? What are some of the management tools that are in the toolbox for dealing with nuisance species?
Mr. Chair, it depends, of course, on the species you're talking about. For some species, we really don't have management, like mitten crabs, for example. In that case, the management is to prevent their introduction and spread. Green crabs are already fairly widespread in coastal estuaries, and there's really no management of those. It takes research to develop some sort of biological management. For aquatic noxious weeds that are nuisances in systems, I mean, there's a whole gamut of everything from grass carp to herbicides to physical control methods available. And what we try and do when we develop weed management plans is look at all these different methods and use a combination is the most appropriate for that particular weed species in a given situation. So we consider herbicides, chemical control, physical control, harvesting or mechanical removal, as well as biological agents such as grass carp and other insect species that are specific for certain aquatic weed species.
We've seen some photographs of the zebra mussel in infestation, I guess you'd call it, or in irrigation pipes, and it's clear that it can just completely block the flow of water into that system. And I guess I would like to hear how you deal with that kind of an explosion of biota in a relatively close place. How do you deal with it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, zebra mussels are a very scary introduction. And again, I don't think on a large scale there is any management. In pipes like that, there's some chemicals that are used. Sometimes they use heat to sort of shock them, or low dissolved oxygen. They put water in the pipe that's got very low dissolved oxygen. There's some coatings that you can put on the inside of pipes. And there are companies developing these little sort of like little rotor-rooter things that go through the pipes and just sort of clean them out. But, prevention of zebra, again, that's an organism we don't have yet, as far as we know, and we need to develop prevention programs to try and keep it out of the state for as long as possible. I don't think that anybody would say that we can prevent zebra mussel introductions forever. They're going to get here someday. But if you can delay it for a year or two, we will save ourselves thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars in treatment costs just to manage these sort of problems that you just brought up.
And then with hydrilla, is that basically a chemical agent that you use to get rid of that?
Well, with hydrilla, if we find a small infestation, we would want to try and eradicate it. And oftentimes, chemical agents are the most efficient, sort of cost-effective way to do that. If we find a huge infestation, if we found hydrilla all over Ten Mile Lake, for example, it wouldn't be very effective to use a herbicide in that case. And you'd have to look at some other sort of maintenance control because it'd be out of control and it couldn't be eradicated. So again, it depends on the size of the infestation, how you'd approach it.
Representative Thompson and then Senator Cameron.
I'll take these black cards and handle it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, certainly I have black carp in the Midwest where zebra mussels are running rampant and they're not controlling them. I think there are agents that will eat them. For example, there are waterfowl that eat zebra mussel as well. But I think the zebra mussel are much more prolific than the fish are. So as far as I know, they haven't proven effective in the long run in controlling zebra mussel infestations. Black carp, of course, are a non-indigenous species in Oregon. So.
Senator Turner?
Mud Devils Lake and Ten Mile are coho habitat. Are there other lakes in the state that you know of that are salmonid habitat that have had or have weed problems?
Mr. Chair, Senator Turner, certainly many of the coastal silktooth, tachinids are all salmonid habitat, like silktooth is a fantastic lake that's completely infested with Pisonella, the same weed that's in Ten Mile Lake. So basically every coastal lake that has a boat ramp has been infested by noxious aquatic weeds, and that's because the weeds are transported on trailers, boat trailers quite often. So people back their boat into Ten Mile and they go to Eel Lake, for example, and introduce the plant. So every coastal lake is infested.
So, Mr. Chair, for me, Mark, you make reference to I believe it's the -2 amendments to 3225. And on page 19, line 20, you indicate that we should add language that refers to lake or reservoir after stream. And that would have to do with the issue of weed control in those tributaries or those lakes that do rear and grow salmonid. That's the intent of what you're suggesting.
Yes, Senator, it's certainly true. I mean, there are a number of lakes and reservoirs on DEQ 303D list that this act is referring to. And eventually those management plans will have to be put together for all those lakes and reservoirs that are listed as water quality limited. And certainly it includes weed issues. Weeds are one of the listing criteria for water bodies in Oregon for placing a lake or reservoir on the water quality limited list, the 303D list. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you for that testimony. I appreciate the fact that you made a few trips down here, one for the -1 amendments, and sometimes the train is harder to catch than other times. And we'll add these specifics to our working over this bill as we go through it. And as a matter of fact, there's no other folks that would like to offer testimony this morning in the public hearing session. I think maybe we could share with folks here and the rest of the committee members our intent to go through these sections. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get to the public hearing and possible work session on HJM 7, I think it would be beneficial to just reiterate that our plan is to go through HB 3225 using the dash 2 amendments as just a template, as sort of an organizational approach, and invite the interest groups to bring forward any specific information conceptually or in terms of written documentation or any suggestions they have for inclusion as we go on section by section through that draft. And just to make sure that we get the broadest possible input into the bill. So if there's folks listening out there that want to be involved as we go through our schedule, and have we published our schedule yet? So I think you need to do that. Yeah, I think we need to get that schedule published and make sure folks understand when we're going to be going through the sections on this thing. But that is on the agenda. If there's any questions about organization, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In talking with at least two of you, I know that some of you won't be here tomorrow night, and we're going to have you've seen in your memo, we're going to extend that 1 hour and start working until 7:30. What I would urge you to do is that if you have concerns with the sections we're going to be covering, to get word back to us so that we can include that in the discussion and we don't have to continually keep going back and starting over again. We might have to do that some of that anyway, but at least so we know what your concerns are, we can include that in our discussions.
Representative Steen.
Has the Senate had dinner in its budget for the committee?
We have a, is it, actually we should make these Wednesday nights so we could have the 29 cents. I think we were actually pushing pretty hard, Representative Steen, to get the coffee for the committee.
Yeah, just throw those 29 cent tacos in here and then we'll do Wednesday while we're at it.
That's pretty sad you even know that Wednesday's 29 burgers.
It is, Representative Laird, but we are coping with survival skills at 199.
On our salary, Mr. Chair, what else can we afford?
If there being no comments of substance to come before this committee, we should move to the HJM 7, and I'll ask the staff to make a presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Joint Memorial 7 urges Congress to fund and implement a program to study tinnitus activation on salmonids and to allow state and federal agencies to remove pinnipeds preying on listed fish stocks in areas of restricted fish passage. This is a joint memorial that references the financial commitment Oregon is making under the Oregon plan to recover listed species. It does recognize the failure of the Federal Marine Mammal Protection Act to assist us in that goal. The memorial itself does call for research on pinniped predation, especially site-specific investigations to determine the significance of pinniped predation on stock recovery and to develop a conservation plan that manages both protection of pinnipeds and salmonids. You have at your seat a dash one amendment, I believe, is put forward by Representative Thompson, that would replace language on page 2 of the original bill in line 1, essentially making it more specific, and that is for calling for support of the recommendation by the National Marine Fisheries Service to amend the Marine Mammal Protection Act to provide state and federal agencies with management authority to remove pinnipeds preying on listed fish stocks at areas of restricted fish passage, is how that phrase would read with the dash one amendment. No fiscal revenue statement on this matter.
Colleagues, we've seen the report that was produced by National Marine Fisheries Service at the request of Congress. And this really does move forward the idea that we need to be able to deal with pinniped predation in pinch points where they congregate. We've heard lots of testimony about Herschel, you know, the Ballard Blocks sea lion that was relocated, I don't know, 4 or 5 times and kept figuring out how to get back to the dinner hour. It was just like conditioned to be there. And I guess we've seen some of that same thing happen even at Willamette Falls. So this at least puts Oregon on record from the legislative standpoint of wanting something to move forward with that process. Representative Thompson, do you want to introduce your proposed -1 amendments and discuss those?
Well, they speak for themselves. And it just says at the comma on line 1.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Charman.
Are we in public hearing?
No, as a matter of fact, we need to get into public hearing and work session. So let's open the public hearing. Since we've introduced the -1s on the bill.
It gives the federal state a management authority. It's more a little more explicit language, and that's what the goal is. I don't want to mislead anybody to think that this is going to be solved with 1 or 2 animals. This is a Ballard Lock situation. Reality is these are a threat in several areas up and down along our coastal estuaries, and we need the management authority to address them. If we're going to spend millions and millions of dollars for salmon recovery, we need to have at least the authority to remove those animals in those critical areas to make sure we get those fish back to the ocean.
Any further discussion before we ask for commentary from the witnesses from the public that have asked to testify?
Yes, sir.
Representative Nestle and Representative Lynn.
I'm just wondering if we're going quite far enough, because we need to define what the population needs to be to sustain that population. I think the situation we have is that we've gone way, way beyond that. And is that part of... I'm not that familiar with it, Terry. Representative Thompson, you might have more input on this, but, you know, at what level of management are we looking for? Should we try to get the government to define that, too?
I don't think you want to ask me that question. My level of management authority might be a little harder than some of the other people in the state. I know that question was asked to Robin Reed or someone like that who is in the state and could make a comment, because I might be a little bit prejudiced.
Well, let's bring forward Robin Brown and ODF&W. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just hoping that at some point we're going to hear some discussion about what the argument against something like this would be. It's sort of those of us who are familiar with the problem but not the reason for not allowing pinnipeds in Q.
Think you can have some of that discussion before we go into work session. Representative Thompson?
And the reason why it all came about was the Marine Mammal Act was, I don't know, Robin will tell you, a number of years. Hey, you should fill in and do the job, Robin, on why it all came about. And if he misses something, I was there and went through it.
Mr. Brown from ODF and Eddie.
Good morning, Chairs Messerly and Ferrioli, committee members. My name is Robin Brown. I'm with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I have the sometimes dubious honor of being your state agency's marine mammal specialist. I apologize, just a little bit confused on where to start.
Let's start with a little bit of the history and why they first put the Marine Mammal Act in. I think that's what his question was.
Mm-hmm. The Marine Mammal Protection Act was first passed in 1972 by Congress, and the major concerns for original enactment were some very large-scale problems around the world, including international concern for commercial whaling, reduction in populations of certain large whale species. Locally, meaning in the U.S., particularly along the West Coast, one of the major concerns was the yellowfin tuna fishing industry that changed from hook and line type fishery to a purse seine fishery, and the industry found that by setting their purse seine net around schools of porpoise and dolphin, that they could find large numbers of tuna associated with those animals. And over a period of time from the late 60s and into the very early 70s, it was discovered that large numbers of porpoise and dolphins were being killed in this fishery. And a number of other examples around the country about concern for different populations of marine mammals. What many wildlife biologists might consider happened at that point was that the concern for these real issues, biological issues, where populations were being affected by human activity, when the law was passed to provide protection for some of those species, it was a blanket authority over, or blanket management, blanket protection layer given to all marine mammal species regardless of the actual conditions of their populations. So that it not only applied to large whales and just dolphins and porpoises, but also to all seals and sea lions in U.S. waters and the activities of all U.S. citizens around the world. The Marine Mammal Protection Act is actually very, very successful in the area of providing protection to seals and sea lions and seeing to the recovery of their populations. Prior to 1972, most states had bounties of some sort or another. There was a paid bounty or a bounty hunter fisherman in the Columbia River that kept seal and sea lion numbers in the Columbia River low. Populations of seals and sea lions in this part of the country were reduced far below the levels that occur today. So the law has actually succeeded in providing great protection for these animals, and their populations have recovered dramatically, doubling and tripling in number in many cases since the law was enacted in 1972. So now the problem is that we have these very healthy and abundant populations of seals and sea lions that are provided nearly complete protection by the federal law. And in many cases, these animals come into conflict situations with other important marine resources, and in this case, we're looking primarily at depressed salmonid stocks, salmon and steelhead, that are listed federally and or by the state. And so we have a protected seal and sea lion impacting a protected salmon or steelhead, and there's no cohesive way to deal with this problem. The current laws do not allow management of the seal and sea lions in these situations where they may be impacting other important marine resources. So the proposal that has been developed by the National Marine Fisheries Service in consultation with the states of California, Oregon, and Washington, and with the help of the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, was to allow granted a very limited additional authority to state or federal resource agencies to kill, to lethally remove small numbers of seals and sea lions from these very healthy and abundant populations in situations where fish passage is restricted and predation is obviously occurring on stocks of fish that are listed either by the state or the federal government as being threatened or endangered. I describe it as a fairly minor step towards obtaining some sort of reasonable management authority that would allow us to deal with some of the most specific and acute problems. Many folks, of course, feel it's not going far enough and that there are other problems with seals and sea lions up and down the coast that this particular authority may not provide any management action towards. But as hard as it is to get even a minor change accomplished in the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which is supported nationally, of course, and from a very broad constituency across the country, we feel that this request for authority might have a fair chance of being accomplished.
Further questions? President Morgan.
I believe I heard you say there was a bounty on seals and sea lions at some point. Can you give me a reason why that was there?
Chair Farrelly, Representative Morgan. Bounties in the U.S. and probably around the country were in effect primarily because of the perception that seals and sea lions compete directly for people, for fish resources, mutually desirable fish resources. In many cases, there was not necessarily biological data to back up the presumption that seals and sea lions were affecting fish populations to such a level
that it restricted or reduced the ability of people to harvest those fish. But nevertheless, that perception was there, and it is true that fish are the primary prey for seals and sea lions. So basically, to reduce the competition for those fish resources was the typical reason why bounties were in place.
Follow-up question, Mr. Morgan.
What I was trying to get at was there a period of time there that bounty was in effect?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, in Oregon, Washington, I can't give you the exact date, but there were bounties on the legal records from the early 20s through the late 1960s.
President Thompson?
If you don't mind, I'd like to answer your question a little more.
Absolutely.
Thoroughly. Robin and I have worked on this issue off and on over the years. In our bays and estuaries, these seals, after the Marine Mammal Act, up till that point, we had a lot of other fish besides salmon. I hate to tell anybody in the group or anybody in the state, there's other fish in the state besides salmon, but don't let anybody bring them to the shop. There's yellow red-tailed perch and several perch species and flounder. They were doing well. And at the time the implementation of the Marine Mammal Act, you could literally watch starry flounder populations collapse as the seals started to, and sea lions started to come back into those bays. And there was no fear. Up to that point, we'd harassed them out of there. See, we're not even allowed to harass them. And we kept them out of there, and those fish need to come to the estuary in order to spawn. So you have this large quantity of marine mammals there, and these species are coming back in fairly dense numbers. And it was just a frenzy there on some of those spawning grounds for a short period of time. Today, there's very few of those fish left. I think if we had the way of calculating the numbers, we might have more problems than we do with salmon. And the fishermen who fished salmon started harvesting the seals. But remember now, it wasn't the first time, because the Indians, if you go look at the reds up and down in the Mittens, that's down the coast, there's a lot of signs of seals, and seals particularly in some areas. So it's true that we did harvest them down in numbers, and I would never want to go to see that low of a population, but likewise, I don't want to see it maintained in a population where no fish can live in any of these areas.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Leonard, and then Representative Moore,
did you have a follow-up?
Well, I don't know if anyone knows the answer to this, but in reading about issues related to salmon, it appears to be cyclical. There are times when salmon just don't come back, and there's times when they do come back. And I'm curious if whether when this bounty was enacted, as you say, in the 1920s, if that was one of those cyclical low points in salmon harvesting. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, why at that point in time was the decision made to put a bounty on those predators?
Chair Ferriola, Representative Morgan, I'm not sure I can answer that question specifically, except to say that long before the bounty was ever put in place, I'm sure that seals and sea lions still were killed, and their populations kept at low numbers in bays and estuaries and coastal waters, again, because of the understanding that they were fish predators. Why the bounty was actually put on the books at that particular time, I couldn't really say. But it's true that long-term ocean conditions and other environmental factors that affect fish populations, particularly salmonid populations, in these big cycles. But I would venture to say probably back in the 20s, of course, most of these fish populations were in much better shape than they are now, and so I don't know that that would have been why the bounties were enacted at that point in time.
Mr.
Representative Thompson.
Yeah, question, and I'm not trying to upstage you, but my grandfather was a gill netter on the South Sea and the Columbia. My great-grandfather was a gill netter on the Columbia. And my father was running pickup boats on the Aquinnah, the Coquille, and the Alsea. And there the problem was that the seals loved to go in and just bite the bellies out of the salmon. And there was a lot more fish.
and it would be simply a matter of economics. It was, if you had a net full of fish and you were going to feed 10% of them with come up with just a stomach ripped out of them, you soon picked up your gun, and after a while they decided they weren't being effective just shooting for one, that they went out and put a bounty up so people would remove them before the gillnet season started. It was originally a county bounty in our area, and then was later implemented as a state bounty.
Representative Leonard, did you have some questions?
Just one, and I think kind of answered it, and that's just historically, what was the nature of the balance of the seals and the salmon? Had there have been some kind of ecological process of selection or something that kept the populations down that isn't occurring now because of the large harvest, or is it in part due to the ocean conditions? I'm just curious what happened before we arrived.
Chair Ferrioli, Representative Leonard, I'm struggling a little bit to answer that question, but I mean, I usually start out by saying that, you know, clearly seals and sea lions and many marine fish species, including salmonids, have coexisted successfully for tens of thousands of years. I think Representative Thompson's remarks are right on the money that the interaction and interference with commercial fishing operations was largely behind the need to try to remove these animals from the immediate fishing areas, and that probably led to the development of the bounties. We don't have good historical information on the numbers of seals and sea lions that occurred in this part of the world, although, as it was pointed out, seal and sea lion remains show up in many of the middens from the coastal natives that lived in this area, so they were utilized to some degree. Again, other than to say that there was some balance there over many, many years, and what this proposal from National Marine Fisheries Service that the states have signed on to addresses really is the situations where the fish stocks have been already severely depressed for any number of reasons. And we have small numbers of predators, usually in a certain area. They're part of a very healthy and abundant population. And this recommendation would provide authorities for the state or federal agencies to remove those animals in those specific cases.
Any further? Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up a little bit on Representative Thompson's questions. I talked to folks who took seals and sea lions for bounty over the years at the Columbia. And Representative Thompson's right. You'd pull up a net full of fish, and all you had were heads and tails. Obviously not very valuable. I mean, in those days, we didn't have much of an industry for turning it into pet food. So this is even 20 years ago, we didn't. So that load wasn't worth much. Sports fishermen had the same problem, however. You could go out to catch a salmon on a rod and reel and pull it up, and you had a head. Not very conducive for that sort of thing, but I don't want anyone to think that it's a kind of bounty system like we have today for squawfish, because it wasn't. It was never let's get rid of them all or see how many we can get rid of. The folks that I've talked to, it sounds like it was a pretty responsible plan. They had often had trouble getting their boats out of the harbor in Astoria and Warrenton and Hammond, and this, excuse me for anybody this may offend, they say you take one and they wouldn't have any trouble for a few weeks getting your boat out of harbor anymore, because these are actually very smart animals. And they were kept in cold storage in Astoria. ODFW would come down and inspect them and then pay the bounty. It was a very limited bounty. Limited in that you had to be approved, and your take had to be approved afterwards. They went out to decimate the population, but they were out to control it so that sort of both sides could coexist.
The report that was prepared at the request of Congress by the National Marine Fisheries Service goes further than our joint memorial does. It actually talked about that. Fishermen being given the authority to protect their catch in their year from predations by pinnipeds. So, Representative Thompson.
We actually had that authority, Robin, for a few years after 1972. I know he's in the Herring Fishery Club A, if you use it. And I think it was until about 1978. Do you remember the year that we lost that authority?
Sheriff Arioli, Representative Thompson, the commercial fishermen were allowed to protect their gear and catch up to and including shooting to kill seals and sea lions up through 1994. So it was the amendment process in 94 that Congress removed that authority. And this, as Sheriff Arioli points out, the NMFS document recommends reinstating that authority, and the basis for that being that these populations of seals and sea lions did not decline from 1972 to 1994 as fishermen had and used that authority, so it clearly didn't impact the populations in a negative way. So National Fisheries Service feels that that authority could be reinstated and not cause significant harm to the populations.
President Thompson, excuse me for not remembering the year. He's absolutely right, but there was a, we were ahead about 4 or 5 years in there that we didn't even need to report. Then they started the reporting process, and that went on, and I don't remember what year because I don't get involved in the direct removal in my fisheries on the end. There was a time period when we didn't have to report, then they put in the reporting.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Shouldn't we in this bill at least support what the National Marine Fisheries Service recommends, which is to allow the fishermen to protect the gear and their, why would we not want to go that far?
Committee? We could incorporate the report by reference fairly easily. And we could go into work session, refer to the report by, or pull the report into the amendments by reference. But before we go into work session, have we answered the questions of those that had the desire to get the background?
The only question I have is I'm just surprised, given the uproar last session over dogs chasing sheep, there isn't somebody here to give another viewpoint.
That we could refer the bill to Senator Bryant. Chase the dog. Actually, I think the... There's a fair degree of sensitivity to the issue of the Marine Mammals Act. Obviously, Save the Whales arguably started the environmental movement, at least the rise of people's consciousness of those issues. But this committee showed voluminous evidence about the explosion of seal and sea lion and pinnipin population. And we've got other listed species of the... The issue is when you've got stocks of salmon that are so depressed that there may be only a few tens or hundreds of a returning run, and you compare that to the tens of thousands of seals and sea lions and pinnipeds and the millions of shorebirds that are predate on these fish, then it puts it in a little different perspective. If the committee's comfortable, I'd like to go to
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Mr. Brown, if I heard you correctly, that this is not going to solve the population problems in areas such as Gold Beach, where you just have a huge number of sea lions out there. And what I heard you say with this bill would work towards where you have specific problems, just a very small number of sea lions that have bad habits. So what do you see, how are we going to, I guess that's what my earlier question was, should we be referring to the management level or the population levels that we should be setting our goals for?
Co-Chair Meatherly, that's certainly within your purview to do so. I will mention that the committee that worked on developing these recommendations, the states of California, Oregon, and Washington, with Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission, tackled that idea of optimal sustainable population as well. And after several days of discussion and debate, felt that at least we didn't think we could propose something that was likely to be taken up by Congress as an amendment to the Marine Mammal Protection Act. There's no doubt, it's very clear that the question of optimum sustainable population is defined
as written into the law and defined under federal regulation by NIMS, is a very difficult and almost unworkable population regime to manage within, because basically it says we really don't know that we're at the optimum level for seals and sea lions until they just don't grow anymore. And that may very well be where we're approaching with harbor seals, not with California sea lions. I would suggest it's clearly would be an important point to make, that the difficulty of operating under the optimum sustainable population regime exists and is a real problem. What to offer in its place and instead, our group could not determine and couldn't make a suggestion we thought would make much progress.
President Thompson, then Representative Senator Connell.
Robin, I know that Congress is about to open the Marine Mammal Act again. Have they opened that yet?
Chair Perry, only Representative Thompson. I don't believe they have as yet. They're scheduled to look at it for amendments and reauthorization sometime this spring or summer. Joe Rolater with our department will be following that very closely, along with Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission, and we certainly plan to provide testimony and comment during that period.
Follow-up there, Representative Thompson.
I know that when that starts, I hope that this committee gets advice. My intention is to fly back and to try to get some real input into Congress. Remember, this memorial is probably appropriate, but just like any time you come before any legislative committee, things can get changed. I'm still hopeful that maybe I can convince some people back there that the way they see marine mammals and the way that we see them when we live with them is completely different, no more different from the coyote issue is to the farmer that's living there, and that they'll give us a little bit more authority because of the salmon and the endangered species as a state basis, but also as a people that live with the fish. We need to be able to create a balance between these animals and the nature around them. And so I hope they give us that authority.
Senator Turner.
And Mr. Chair, I tend to agree with the dash from limits proposed by Fish and Wildlife because it just says provide management authority. It gives the ability to deal with the critters and next policy to be broad enough. Yes, it's focused.
Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Rolater, did you have something to say?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Joe Rolater. I'm the assistant to the director of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Several references have been made today to Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. The commission was established in 1938, and it's made up of Oregon, Washington, fish managers in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, California, and Alaska. We meet twice a year. We will be meeting, the in-state, the Oregon group, will be meeting in the conference room on the fourth floor of the house on Thursday morning. I am the in-state coordinator. We have a Washington, D.C. lobbyist who keeps track of a number of things. And Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission funnels research for fisheries into the state agencies, and also lobbies for things that benefit fisheries on the West Coast. This issue of pinnipeds is very important to us. And as Robin has said previously, when the hearings on the reauthorization of the Marine Mammal Protection Act come to Congress, I expect that we will try to get a fisherman from the West Coast, hopefully Representative Thompson, to be called to testify at those hearings. And I will, depending upon your schedule, I will try to go there myself. So we as a department and the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission will be following very closely reauthorization of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the reappropriation of the research money that we as a state have now and hope to continue to do these population assessment studies that Robin's been talking about. Thank you.
Colleagues,
Senator Shields, and apologies that we have a member that needs to leave, so we need to move this bill.
Yeah, I also have to get them on another committee. I just wanted to know, since this is a study and so on, what's the time lag between, usually between such a study as this and the actual implementation of this kind of management?
Well, Senator Shields, in this case, the study is completed, and the recommendation has been made, so theoretically, in this Congress could act and give this authority back to states.
Okay.
So we could be on a relatively short timeline, especially in consideration of the fact that Representative Thompson will be taking this bill back to Washington, D.C., and of course, when Thompson is our man in D.C. and he's carrying out Joint Memorial 007, I think we can expect some rather quick action.
I would like to make one last brief comment. I do not have a conflict of interest with this bill in that this bill doesn't directly impact any fisheries that I'm involved in, so it's not like I'm trying to go out and set in my own nest by the damage that we do.
Control mechanisms.
Yes.
If there are no further discussions, let's move into work session on House Joint Memorial 007. We're in work session. Colleagues, what's your pleasure?
Move the dash one, Mr. Chair.
Senator Tarno moves the dash one amendment to House Joint Memorial 007. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objections to the amendment? So moved.
Move the bill as amended to the floor. Due pass recommendation.
Senator Tarno moves House Joint Memorial number 7 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative
King.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. The House Joint Memorial 7 passes both chambers from this committee and will lead to health care, and I would like to Representative Thompson to get the practice for carrying House Joint Memorial 007 to Washington, D.C., so he will carry the bill in the House. And that concludes the business before the committee today. Thank you very much, and we are in adjournment.